We now have three cases to be heard, 2014-2008, 2009, and 2010. And my understanding is that perhaps we can obtain some judicial economy if we present a single argument.
Yes, thank you very much.
Do you need 30 minutes or 15, or what do we set the clock at?
I think 20?
How about 20 minutes?
20 sounds good.
All right.
Because I think I will need all the 15, but not much more.
Okay, well, let's set it for 20 minutes then.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so Ms. Gorey.
Thank you. May it please the court. Again, I'm Kelly Gorey of Rich and Gillis Law Group. I'm here today on behalf of the Erie County Auditor, who is with us this morning, and the Erie County Board of Revision. This case has fairly similar facts, in fact, to the case that we were just speaking of. There's a couple differences here. The tax year involved in these cases is tax year 2013. One of the most important arguments, I believe, and that which was entirely ignored by the BTA, was whether or not the recent revisions to 57-1303 apply to the resolution of this appeal. In my brief, I went through the legislative history. It's kind of complicated, actually, with the original House Bill 487 containing that effective date clause, which created, I believe, mass confusion, which then led to the repeal of the effective date clause in House Bill 510. And what I'm alleging in my brief is that there's no doubt, if we look at both of those legislative acts together, that the revisions were in fact effective on March 27th of 2013. In terms of whether or not these apply to tax year 2013, I think there are two specific sort of lines of thought that we can look at. The first is in the Columbus City Schools case, which involved the no-walk. It's a short sale case. The court noted in the beginning of its discussion regarding the version of 57-1303 to be applied to that case that when the case arose, the version of 57-1303, in effect, was when the complaint was filed. So a case arises in terms of the valuation complaint under 57-1519 when it's filed with the Board of Revision. So being that this was a tax year 2013 case, the complaint was filed in March of 2014. So in fact, the House Bill 510 revisions had been effective for nearly 1 year. It's our position that under the authority of Columbus, the revisions most certainly do apply to this case. But I will note that also in Subpoena and Hinn 2, the court in footnotes said in both cases that the court must apply the substantive tax law in effect for the tax year. Well, there's no doubt that the revisions, the House Bill 487 initial revisions potentially could have been applicable as of January 1 of 2013, but for the effective date clause, but we're not really sure what that means because the court didn't have an opportunity to address it before it was repealed.
So your position is that this case arises when the complaint is filed.
Correct.
As opposed to the other alternative, which would be the underlying
lien
valuation, which would be January 1st of the tax year at issue.
Right. Our position is that when a complaint is filed, if we look at this, the law of the land on the books that as of that time, we are going to see in 57-1303 that the word shall was in fact replaced with may, and that has been on the books for nearly a year. And I think I also included...
So under your interpretation, what would the duty of the auditor have been then during 2013 in assessing the property for that year? Would it be governed by
The new revisions.
Governed by the new provision because those actions would occur after March 27th.
Correct. So when the auditor would have been certifying the tax year 2013 values, he would have been doing that in December, or actually November of 2013. The revisions would have been on the books then for approximately 6 months. But I think if we look at subpoena and HIN, I don't think that interpretation is necessarily inconsistent with what the court said in subpoena and HIN as well, because if we go back to 57-15-19, which authorizes the filing of the complaint, the statute actually refers to the current tax year, and it says that complaints for the current tax year may be filed in March of the ensuing calendar year. So if we use the words in the statute, the current tax year, and then put that in subpoena and HIN's language, it's not inconsistent because the law on the books, when the complaint was filed for the current tax year, then would also be the substantive law in effect for that tax year. I think we get into a different situation where I'm digressing here a little bit, but let's say, for example, tax year 2012. Theoretically, someone could have filed a complaint on March 31st of 2013. Would the revisions have been on the books? Yes, but they weren't on the books as of January 1 of 2012 when a complaint could have been filed. So then you would be potentially applying two different law to complaints for the same tax year. Clearly, that would not be constitutional.
Is there any indication in looking at the legislation why March 27th would have been the date?
I could not figure that out.
Were there other things in the bill and that was a general date for all of the things?
I'm assuming that the rest of the entire bill was effective on March 27th of 2013, and then when they repealed that effective date clause, there's no effective date clause for the revisions to 57-1303.
The later legislation has a provision that says we hereby repeal
exactly
that earlier effective date, and then stops saying anything. And then the new legislation then has its own
effective date.
Is that an effective date that's specifically stated in the act, or is it just when it was actually enrolled or whatever?
I believe it's when it's, I think the governor signs it, and then it takes effect a certain time after the governor signs it.
So it's not...
Unless there's a specific effective date clause.
Right. So there wasn't a specific date that the legislature wrote into the act.
I do not believe so.
Okay.
And I will note that the statute was discussed by the 5th District Court of Appeals in a case called Olentangy Local Schools Board of Revision, which was a case that, coincidentally, I argued before the 5th District Court of Appeals. But I made the same argument that I'm making here, that I think you have two potential dates. You either have when the complaint is filed, when the case arises, or the law that is in effect as of the actual lien date. The court, that was a tax year 2012 case, and the 5th District Court of Appeals concluded that the revisions were not applicable to the case. They discussed my argument and merely said that the owner did not rebut it. And so I'm not sure if that was an implied acceptance of my argument, but regardless, they said tax year 2012, the revisions were not in effect. Overall, our position is that if the law is on the books when the complaint is filed, and I think it goes both ways, and certainly I think there's a much better argument if it's a procedural rule, say the revisions to whom can file a complaint. If a owner is looking at the statute on the day that it files its complaint and sees that provision on the books, shouldn't that govern the resolution of that complaint? So it is our position that the revisions do in fact apply to this appeal, and it's a plain plain language reading of the statute that we're urging.
And that helps you because substantively, getting to the merits, the word may is better
Correct.
Than shall.
Correct. And if we look at Justice Pfeiffer's dissent in the Hinn 2 case, I think his interpretation of the revisions is extremely consistent with what we are urging. And it, in fact, is a plain language reading, that may does, in fact, mean may, and that confers discretion not only upon the auditor, but also upon the BOR, the BTA, and this court in failing to use or in deciding to reject a sale price as the best evidence of value. And as you will note in this case, the BOR noted that Mr. Dauch didn't appear to talk about the sales here. We have no evidence of the arm's length nature of the sales. In our opinion, this is the perfect circumstance in which that may language was properly utilized by the Board of Revision to reject the sale. And then I want to spend a couple of minutes on the presumption, which we were also talking about in the case prior. I think there's several reasons why the presumption should not apply to an owner who files its complaint based upon its own sale. First, if we look at the history of the presumption, I think this court's been extremely clear that the presumption arises because a Board of Education is entitled to file an increased complaint based upon a sale price. A Board of Education obviously is not a party to a sale, as neither is the county auditor or the county Board of Revision. They don't have any personal knowledge of the facts or circumstances surrounding the sale. A presumption arises in the absence of facts to be proven. Because the Board of Education can't prove the arm's length nature of the sale, I believe that's why the court enacted the presumption. And I think that started in about the mid-90s with the Columbus City Schools case. And then there's been the Worthington, which was the Weber sisters, Bobo Link. There's the First Cal Industrial. There's been several cases throughout the years where the court has specifically noted our cases acknowledge that when a Board of Education files an increased complaint, the sale is to be presumed arm's length subject to rebuttal by the owner. And I think this makes perfect sense because the owner is the party who possesses all of the knowledge regarding the sale. They simply have to appear at the BOR to tell the BOR about the sale, and that's how they're able to rebut the presumption. So that's the second factor of why we believe the presumption should not apply, is how does the county BOR, without having a witness or evidence to utilize at the hearing, how does it rebut the sale price? It's an unrebuttable presumption. And it's also, in our opinion, a shifting of the original burden of proof that the complainant owner bears when they file a complaint. And it's a heavy burden of proof. So what the BTA has done is essentially shifted the original burden of proof back to the county on the auditor's original valuation, which is the default valuation, and then required the county to somehow prove, without any evidence or witnesses, that it's not an arm's length transaction. Our position is the presumption never needs to arise because the owner possesses all the facts regarding the sale. It's as simple as they file the complaint, appear before the BOR to talk about the sale. And we don't believe that's an unreasonable burden to place upon the owner. So even if the presumption arises and the owner doesn't appear at the BOR hearing, our statutes provide that the BOR is the best party to hear the original complaint. It is best poised as the local governing body to originally decide the merits, the substantive merits of the valuation complaint. And if we look to 5715.19G, that actually provides that all evidence that is within the complainant's knowledge and possession at the time of the BOR hearing cannot be presented on appeal unless the complainant demonstrates good cause. If you look at these two together, so say the presumption is even to arise. The owner appeals. Well, in this case, it was their non-attorney tax consultants, tax compliance services, who appealed to the BTA. If the presumption were to arise, and I would say then subpoena the owner at the BTA hearing, I would subpoena them, yet at the same time, I would object to any testimony because it was to be presented to the BOR. So that's another reason why the county cannot possibly rebut a presumption if it arises at the BOR. The issue was raised in the Ginter case, and I would note that the facts here are different because the Board of Revision took jurisdiction over these cases and elected not to change the values. It was not a dismissal for a failure to prosecute. So we believe not only will the 57-1303 revisions, but also the issue of the presumption are ripe for this court to discuss and rule upon. And then there was one final thing I wanted to note. What the BOR did the BTA in two of these cases, when preparing the statutory transcript, the conveyance fee statement and the questionnaire that the auditor sends out after the sale was included in the statutory transcript. The county didn't have any duty to include those because they weren't part of the evidence that was presented by the complainant. And so the statutes actually say that the County Board of Revision has to certify a copy of the complaint and all evidence offered in connection therewith. My argument is that if the Board of Revision did not rely upon that evidence, which it clearly did not, if you read the BOR transcript, you will see that the BOR's concern was, well, we don't have a witness here. We don't have anyone to talk about the sale. We don't have facts to determine whether or not it was arm's length. If the BOR elects not to rely upon that evidence, the BTA then can't turn around and say, simply because it was included in the transcript, we're going to use it as substantive evidence of value. But I think that ultimately doesn't matter, because if the BOR was allotted the pure discretion to reject the sale, technically it doesn't matter what they relied upon or they did not rely upon. And then similarly, if the presumption doesn't arise, there was no need for the county to rebut anything on appeal. I did discuss that in my brief, and I believe that was, at least in two of the three cases, basically the BTA's sole evidence it relied upon for accepting both of these sales. But we would believe that, in sum, at a minimum, the BTA decision doesn't even cite the statute. The court certainly could remand to the BTA if it finds that the revisions could be applicable to a tax year 2013 case. Since the BTA didn't address this at all, it certainly could remand back to the BTA for them to initially address that argument if it would prefer. Also, we would believe that a straight reversal would be warranted based both upon 57-1303 and then the fact that the presumption never arose. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ms. Gorey. Again, we have no appellee appearing today, so this case will be these cases, all three of them, will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.
Thank you very much.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned. Thank you.